The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
May 18, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and it is Woden's Day, Wednesday, the middle of the week. Last I checked. Anyhow, that's what it says. Of course, you could be hearing us at another time during another, well, let's see, during another time, at another place. Is it at another time? It doesn't matter. Look, we could get into the linguistics and all of that, but let's stick with the simplistic. This is the Ocelli Effect. You already know that. All right. So in the first hour, who do I have with me? I have my friend Amir from Ukraine. This is where he lives. Now, he may not sound as though he's Ukrainian, but that's because he's actually not. He moved there some years ago, right on time, actually, for when, in my opinion, the actual invasion from Russia began, which is, maybe what, 8-9 years ago, something like this now? Yeah, that's when that was actually starting to happen. Of course, we've been treated to the past, 3 months now of what's going on in Ukraine and what's being claimed by the Russian media outlets, the apologists for the Russian media outlets, the American media outlets who were virtue signaling for quite a while, claiming as though they care about displaced people in times of war. Usually they don't. Just telling you. But it is what it is, and I got myself in trouble a couple of times bringing this guy on the air. More than happy to do so, because I just ask him what's happening, and he happens to be there. And wait a minute, isn't that what journalists should be doing? I don't know. Maybe I've lost my mind somewhere. He's not the only guy I've heard from in Ukraine. They all tell me similar stories, but what can I say? I'm not actually there. Am I? And neither are most of the people that are commenting on this and passing judgment on what's happening. But anyway, enough out of me. Let's talk to our friend who we have not heard from in a little bit. Of course, we did get to hear from him at one point and his lovely wife, Alla, on a whole different show. And we talked about the history, what's actually going on, the conflict before it was the conflict that is. Anyway, it's good to check in with you. How you doing tonight, Amir?
I'm doing fine considering we were displaced from the Ukrainian part of Donetsk Oblast and from Pokrovsk, which is the city we used to be in. It was, as I have explained before, it's very close to the contact line, about 40 miles as the crow flies. But it's held out this entire time, so the city has remained free of Russian capturing and invasion so far. It's in a pocket, that the Russian army has not been able to penetrate. So, but it's very close to the heavy shelling and fighting as they're trying to take Donetsk. So it's a dangerous place to be, and most most people have evacuated from there. Like, for example, in our block of flats, our next door neighbor, he's a train driver, so he stayed because out of duty, not because he was forced to, but just for a sense of duty. So he drives shunting locomotives at the train station, and it's, that's a dangerous place to be because the Russians are bombing the railway stations to try and stop deliveries of offensive help and defensive help for the Ukrainian army. So him and his wife, they're at risk. We've now relocated to Lutsk, which is in northwestern Ukraine. It's about the same distance from the Belarusian border as it is from the Polish border. So this is a really nice city, and we're doing okay considering. What's happened recently in, as you probably know, they lost in the north. The Ukrainian army defeated them in Kiev because they wanted to encircle the city and obviously replace the government with their puppet government. And that, because Maria Novosti published an article too early about how, you know, the war was, you know, the war was won in a few days, and you know, and we'd been saved from ourselves and denazified. So that was quickly taken down. So, you know, the thing is with these all media outlets who are all just pretty much, well, Kremlin outlets echoing Kremlin talking points, have now gone to the talking point, which is a hilarious talking point. Oh, the Russian army has been showing restraint, and you know the objective at Kiev was to trick the Ukrainian army into going up there, so they could then go to the east and take, you know, all of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. And that's just that's just hilarious, because if you look at, there's plenty of photos of flattened, you know, Ukrainian cities like Mariupol, like where just blocks of flats have been bombed. They're not, when you're showing restraint, you don't bomb civilian flats, right? So that these clowns have all picked up that talking point. Like, the Russian army has been massively overestimated. They are a decrepit, fourth-rate army, and they are not the powerful, great army that all these alt media, you know, pro-Russian, effective Kremlin outlets have been saying. It's just not true. They're qualitatively far less more effective than the Ukrainian army, because they're still operating on Soviet methods and doctrines and thinking, right? The Ukrainian army was modernized. In 2014, it wasn't doing too well, because it still had, you know, the legacy of the Soviet, you know, doctrines and methods and backwards thinking of Soviet methods. And the Ukrainian army has been modernized, and with the help of especially the Canadians under Operation Unifier, and you had guys like Patrick Henningsen, who were sort of laughing, you know, going, "Oh, look, an ammunition dump got blown up, and that's your tax dollars going up in flames," and just laughing about it, laughing about, you know, us losing our defensive capability. Well, guess what? And he thought that we'd just cave in a few days, and he was, you know, they're all wrong, right? They all think the Russian army is some great army that is qualitatively, you know, powerful as, say, the US army, and it's not, right? It's a decrepit, there's a lot of corruption in the army, like the thing with the tires, right, the dry rot in the tires. I think they were falsely blamed on being cheap Chinese tires. No, it's not that. That dry rot. That there's so much corruption that the money for replacing the tires was stolen, and they all just started failing when they went into war. You know, things like that.
There's all this, Amir. I want to ask you a couple of questions, because you're going into a lot of areas here, and obviously, you know, I'm not one of these alt media clowns that you're referring to, because I look at this differently from them. But I got to be honest with you, I thought that the Ukrainian defenses just numerically would not be able to hold up against what the Russians would offer here. So, frankly, I'm amazed that more cities have not fallen. Now, apparently, and according to reports, I don't know if those outlets or the idiots over here in the West, either way, are reporting everything that's happening, because I'm getting word about stuff that's happening there that it seems like none of them are bothering to notice. Mariupol has basically fallen, though. That seems to be a thing that nobody wants to acknowledge publicly, directly. But same time, it's interesting to me that they didn't take out Kiev or Kiev. Okay, that's the way they're saying it now. But either way, I'm looking at it and I'm going, well, I'm amazed they didn't do that, because I would have thought that would have been a primary objective. Now, there are some that say, no, this has always been a military operation. They didn't intend to destroy Ukraine. You know, they just wanted to protect the, you know, the Russian separatist part of Ukraine, which needs to be independent. And I look at that whole mess and I say to myself, this is very similar to what many dictatorships do to their neighbors. When they decide that they have a ancestral or philosophical or historical claim on a territory, they just go in and they say, look, this was always ours to begin with. And they go in and they make the claim, and then they say they got to defend the people. And this is common behavior historically. So, you know, even the people that are like, oh, well, Putin's crazy and he's foolish, and I don't think so at all. I'm wondering if this is an incremental plan to recapture all of Ukraine, which was key strategically to the Soviet Union, which was key strategically to the Russian Empire previous to modern times. I'm wondering if they're not looking at it as a way to recapture this, and it's just, okay, there's been some setbacks. We'll claim that we're seated, so to speak, with taking over these two areas over here. And, okay, that territory belonged to us. We've done that. We've accomplished our objective. And, okay, now you guys can go on. And then that's when the real rat turns. You know what I mean? Because then they'll go back in, make another claim. Well, now you're further assaulting these independent areas that we're protecting. And it just starts over again. I'm wondering if that is the case. But also I note that, you know, that nobody wants to report, like I said, Mariupol has fallen. Nobody wants to report that. I mean, again, I'll say this, and I don't know if you're going to like me saying this, but once you engage in war like this, and this is, make no mistake, it is not a huge war because we're talking about a small piece of territory, relatively speaking, the Ukraine. But thing is, once you do this, there is guaranteed going to be, you know, people keep throwing the words war crimes around. Who's a war criminal? What did they do? I mean, recently they featured how the Ukrainians are prosecuting Russian war criminals and how they're handling it. And I'm thinking to myself, there is going to be horrible, horrible things which are going to be done and justified by both sides in this equation simply because it is war. In fact, war itself is a crime in my mind. So the ugliness of it, people want to point their fingers at it and say this side or that side is better or worse. I say, you know what? We don't know actually what's going on, and you will not know until long after it's already been done, number one. Number two, how is it that anybody can justify the aggressor? I always thought that according to the American doctrine, right, the aggressor, we have to help the smaller country. In fact, this is always a constant, it seemed like to me, the whole time I was growing up. We have a smaller country who is being egregiously attacked by a much larger, much more resourceful, because they have more resources, literally. I mean, you can't say that Russia itself and the Russian Federation doesn't have more resources. A much more rich, bigger, more powerful country banging on another one. I always thought that this was supposed to be something that Americans generally, philosophically, were supposed to be against. So I find it strange that we have our mainstream right wing, our really truly right wing but alleged alt media, which is not very independent and does seem to be very friendly to the Kremlin's talking points. We have these people siding with the aggressor. We have our left being almost ineffectual, except for the fact that if you put Joe Biden on the left, the administration has given resources to Ukraine in order for them to have some defensive capabilities. It does seem as though that's happened, despite the fact that we haven't put our own people in there. We haven't flown our own planes over there. We haven't gotten completely directly involved, but we have sent money. We have sent resources, and all of that going on while people want to sit there and undermine, okay, look, Zelensky, the president, this and that. Well, you know, he's being controlled by the Nazis, which I find strange considering that I think he's Jewish, best of my knowledge. I find it strange that people want to say that he's richer than Putin is. He has more money than Putin. And I say, well, if he has more money than Putin, then somebody ripped Putin off, because Putin's been gaining money now for decades. This guy's only been a media figure for a couple of years, got into the presidency, and to the best of my knowledge, has not been part of the graft that was there before and really robbing the Ukrainian people, much like many previous regimes did. So I'm having a hard time swallowing all this, while hearing from people who were actually there, you know, not just you, but others, horrible, horrible things that are being done to them, that are being denied or ignored. Horrible, horrible things. And I ask the American and the Western listener to consider, regardless of the justification, if somebody comes into your territory and starts doing these things to you, how are you going to react? Anyway, Amir, this is all my feelings in a nutshell about this. And I haven't gotten a chance to talk to you in a while, and I want to hear more specifics. First thing I want to say to you, though, before I let you back onto it, is that I'm extremely grateful that you are still alive. Out of three people that I really communicate with fairly easily over there, only two of you are left. Okay. One of them is gone, and I still don't have an explanation as to what happened, except that he definitely was involved in something in the eastern part of the country. And you're in the western part of the country. And the Capitol has not fallen. And I don't know what to say about all this, but I want to hear more about what it is you're able to observe, what it is that you understand being there. If you want to talk about your personal, you know, problem here, because you do have some personal problems. I mean, I noted them briefly on the show, and you sort of corrected me privately because I said that you had banking issues, which, you know, and people that want to mail things over there. Well, I don't know if the mail is working. Maybe some things are functional in the part of the country you're in. But again, disruption and the fact that I'm sure that nobody wants to turn the cameras on people that are having a hard time getting basic resources and people that are being displaced from their homes, whether they had a dog in this fight or not. This is what maybe they wanted to show us for a minute to sympathize with the women and the children that were fleeing. But at this point in time, there's still a lot of people in Ukraine. They're still suffering. And I'm not saying that I believe in military intervention from the U.S. or anything like that. I'm not even supporting that necessarily, but I would understand it if we did this. I would actually understand it if we engaged directly. Anyways, there's all of my feelings in a nutshell, Amir. I'm sorry I took like 10 minutes of your time to do that, but by all means, correct me where I'm wrong. Tell me what I've got, you know, screwed up here. Tell me what's going on there that really nobody is reporting, not just these clowns that claim to be independent journalists who adhere to RT, whether they, you know, or whatever, you know, Sputnik, you name it. All of these outlets that have now given them the English translation so that they know how to speak their Kremlin talking points properly, who have been on a propaganda campaign now for well over a decade to infiltrate exactly the independent media that, you know, I used to enjoy being part of but no longer do. But also the disinformation that's gone all around. I mean, what is it that people are not hearing about that you know of? And tell us about that. And also, I just leave it open to you, man. Speak for yourself about what's going on. Continue, please.
All right, let's talk about this weird situation where the underdog is being demonized and the aggressor is being defended, right? Now, traditionally, yes, in most societies, people do go for the underdog. You know, like in the World Cup, when a small African country does well, everyone's like, this is great. Well, you know, we're going to go for them. But this despicable, vile attitude of most of the old media outlets, you know, some of the big prominent ones, you know, Grey Zone News, you know, Moats TV with that vile rat in a hat. And let's just remember, if you've got a show on RT and you're working for RT, you're literally on the Kremlin payroll because they're funded by the Russian government. So, other outlets that get accused of being, you know, on the Kremlin payroll, that's just absurd. They're just they're just what used to be called Russophiles, right? So, right. And Russophiles have existed for two centuries, right? So there's these non-Slavic people who have always cheered on, you know, the decrepit Russian Empire and Soviet, you know, Union and whatever. But this pertains to like this caveman-brained 19th century thinking of spheres of influence, right? So these alt media guys always bring up the point that, Gorbachev was promised that, you know, by James Baker, who could not actually in an official capacity really make that promise because he didn't control NATO. NATO has to vote to expand, right? And so anyway, the false promise was made, hollow promise that NATO, you know, would not one inch to the east, right? And they bring that up. That was just a promise made to a country that doesn't exist anymore, right? And now, all right, so Russia's a successive state. But they never bring up the fact that the 1991 Belavezhe Accords that ended the USSR, the agreement was between Yeltsin of Russia, Stanislav Shushkevich of Belarus, who just died recently, right? And may he rest in peace. He was one of the few post-Soviet leaders who died a poor man and didn't rob his state blind. And the first independent leader of Ukraine, Leonid Kravchuk, right? They ended the USSR and in those Belavezhe Accords they agreed the borders would just be would stay as is. That's it. All right, and Russia agreed to that under Boris Yeltsin, and then also the 1993 Budapest Memorandum on security guarantees. The same thing was again reiterated that the borders of the old Soviet republics would be agreed as is and would be respected. But these clowns in the alt media keep going on about the promise made to Gorbachev. They never bring up that the in paper agreements made after that. That guaranteed the borders as is. These are just caveman brain 19th century, these people belong, you know, in the 21st century, spheres of influence should not be something that should be advocated. Like, they talk about NATO expansion and how Russia feels threatened by NATO, but what about the smaller countries around Russia who feel threatened by Russia? They never bring that up. Right, and does anyone out there honestly think that if the Baltics, say, for example, let's use the Baltics as examples because they're small, right? Does anyone out there honestly think that if the Baltic nations were not in NATO, that they would not have already been invaded and occupied by now? I mean, that's absurd. They would have already been under back into the Russian Empire again. The new Russian Empire 2.0, all right? And so, look, it's not NATO expansion, it's NATO protection. Talk to anyone in these smaller countries that they want that protection, you know? But these alt media guys, caveman brain 19, you know, the John Mearsheimers and the late Stephen Cohens of this world, you know, that used to apologize for Putin and they need to have a sphere of influence. This kind of thinking does not belong in the 21st century, mm. Right? So there's a lot of hypocrisy going on. Like, for example, they claim to be anti-imperialist, right? Anti-US imperialism, but they're essentially advocating for Russian imperialism.
Right.
It's a massive cognitive dissonance, and they're hypocrites. They're just straight up hypocrites. So Russian imperialism is okay, but US imperialism is not.
Well, right. Let's be fair here for a second, right? About NATO, somebody might say, oh, well, I guess Chuck thinks that NATO is a great idea. It's not that I think it's a great idea, and it has been rife with various criminal conspiracies that have done horrible things. I mean, we could talk about, the operations that took place there where, I mean, there were NATO-backed people that were involved in terrorist operations. This has gone on. Gladio. You know, and I'm extremely familiar with Gladio, especially because it, you know, it was in my ancestral homeland, did a lot of damage. Okay. And there's a whole history to that too. So it's not as though I'm saying, look, this is not a battle between good and evil, but as each nation asserts its own independence, I mean, don't they have a right to decide who they want to make an alliance with? And, you know, being simply reintegrated into the Russian Federation, which, like you said, is more like the Russian Empire 2.0. And by the way, I call the Americans the American Empire, the way that we behaved. Okay. But here's the thing. You know, much like other conquerors, even there are people that come in, even historically. I mean, we could go back to Alexander the Great, couldn't we? And we could look at how, yeah, he would go in and defeat an area, assert his own presence there, and then tell them, no, you know what? The kings or whatever, they bow to me, but they can keep their space. You know, they can keep their thrones. This to me is like what happened with Belarus, because you got a dictator there. That has kept his, you know, kept his power, but he's answering to Putin, right? So either a weak puppet that is installed, okay, or no, you keep your throne, but you're going to answer to me, is just, I don't know, the historical blueprint for how you do this. So anyway, why is Ukraine this target for them? Why? This is always the big question, and now they're trying to posit, well, maybe there's something wrong with Putin. He's losing his mind. I don't think so. I think he's very rational. It's just that his worldview is very different from, say, mine, and it has to be different from, I don't know, people that want to be Ukrainian, who say that we are not part of Russia. We're a different thing. We always were a different thing. It's just that we were under the thumb of the Soviet Union at a certain point. We were under, you know what I'm saying? So how do you get that across to people, though, that are not, you know, Russophiles that want to sit there, Russophiles, whatever you want to call them? And the same weird thing happens, by the way, with British people, too. There are like, you know, what do they call them? Anglophiles over here, right? Where they have this weird kind of worship. Again, I know the PR campaign that was put forth, especially when Obama was in office, is look at your weak leader. Here's a strong man good. This is why you're saying it's like a caveman kind of mentality, because strong man good. That's really all it is. Look at the strong man. That's why he was out playing hockey and on horseback with his shirt off, and why he's the man. You know what I'm saying? This is what they sold to these people who were pissed off at the, you know, seemingly weak leadership, the weak men in the West. So they sold it to them, and they infiltrated what is effectively a weird sphere of right-wing stuff. And that's all it is. So now that we're in this and it's been sold this way, I say that it's more important to focus on what the actual effect is on people, because we're not getting real news out of Ukraine. Even now, even the networks which have backed off now here, the Alphabet Soup has started to back off, Amir, which almost makes me worry for what's going to come next. They wanted to try and throw the nuclear threat at us. They wanted to try and throw the, you know, the great Russian army. We're it's so strange they're being defeated. But as you pointed out, I mean, this has just revealed a lot of the weaknesses that were built in because of corruption and all kinds of other problems. I mean, it's almost astounding to me that any part of Ukraine is standing still, considering, again, just the numbers, the resources, the size of that military alone, if it was focused on it. Now, some of these Russophiles have gone with the, you know, the Russian army is showing restraint, because what other explanation do you have? I mean, let's be honest again. Ukraine does not have the massive, if it's needing $80 billion from us, okay, it doesn't have its own war chest. It doesn't have a substantial enough army, a substantial amount of resources enough to sustain itself, right? But still, it's defying the great Russian bear. Am I crazy?
No, you're not. Look, Yeah, the Ukrainian economy, of course, has been under a lot of stress since the initial invasion in 2014. You know, about a quarter to a half of Ukrainian GDP was lost back then, and then it was slowly regained, and now again, a lot of GDP has been lost because all the ports have been cut off except Odessa, right? Look, with the manpower, Chuck, there's no shortage of Ukrainian manpower. In fact, look, there's some evidence that the Russians have got trouble with manpower. Why? Putin publicly called for the 40,000 Syrians to come here and help the Russian army. If they're so great, why did he need those four? Why did he say, oh, if those 40,000 Syrians want to come here and fight, they can fight? Then there's the Buryats and the Chechens, right? So I think they've got manpower issues. They haven't got war chest issues. I think they're getting nearly $1 billion dollars in gas sales still coming their way, right, every month or a week or whatever it is, right? Yes, definitely here in Ukraine, the government needs money because, people talk about economic warfare on Russia, but they don't mention that Russia's trying to destroy Ukraine's economy, right? It works both ways, and quite frankly, the Ukrainian economy has suffered way more than the Russian economy is suffering. But yes, all right. I don't think the Russians mustered what 150,000 odd men, right? Well, I think the Ukrainian army, in terms of manpower, is actually larger, right? A quarter of a million, right? And then there's a million reservists, right? Who are ready to go into action, the men have to stay in the country, but they don't all have to fight. I sent you that video that I made in Lutsk, and in that video, you'll notice there's women pushing prams, and there was lots of men walking by. So they this. And then again, lies about Ukrainians being press ganged into fighting is just—it's nonsense, all right. Because in the DNR, I told you that story about our friend Irina. Her husband Sergei was kidnapped off the streets. Kidnapped off the streets, right? He text messaged her that he was in some barracks that they didn't have much food. Right? She hasn't heard from him since. We presume that he has probably died. He was used as cannon fodder, right? But that's not happening here. Most men here are volunteering quite happily if necessary, right? Or like I told you about our neighbour who's the train driver, right? He feels that's an essential duty and he stayed. Right? He could have left. He didn't have to stay, right? But the thing is, I don't think we've got manpower issues. We've got, logistical, and material and money issues that the West is thankfully helping with. And my God, those javelins and N-laws, the N-laws from Bojo in Britain and Russia's most modern tank, the T-90M, obliterated. Completely and utterly obliterated here in Ukraine. So anyone who thinks they've got the best gear in the world and they're going to steamroll all over us, well, that's been proven incorrect, right? Just before the war started, when you mentioned we did that show with my missus, right? Remember I said the Ukrainian army's tough; they'll fight, right? They've got the willpower to fight, right? They're fighting for their country, right? Which is something I mentioned. When I first came here in 2014, that's what I noticed. These guys have finally got their country back after, 800 to 1,000 years under the Russian jackboot, and they're not going to give it up this time. Not like 100 years ago when the Red Army marched into Kiev and forced them into the USSR, right? Because there were so many factions fighting to try and establish an independent Ukrainian state after the fall of the Russian Empire. At the end of the First World War, right? So, essentially, I think that this has always been the problem with the USSR and now Russia is they're not too weak and they're not too strong, but they're not this great powerful army that they've been massively overestimated. Like I said, look and with the, one thing with the numbers, right? You know how it's considered that the numbers are being inflated, right? And look, in the fog of war, yes. It's hard to get, you know, that after this nasty business is all over, we'll probably have a better idea of the numbers. But let's keep something in mind historically. The way the Soviets and the Russian Empire used to fight, which is to throw massive human waves at the opposing side and not give a stuff about them, right? That's why they lose so many men. But in the Second World War, right, they were just throwing men, you know, at the Wehrmacht and not giving a stuff if they got killed. Like, Arla told a story about how her great uncles and stuff were sent into war with no guns, right? You know, it's true. So that's just absurdly ridiculous to do stuff like that. And then behind them was NKVD backstop troops. So if they tried to retreat to live to fight another day, which is a sensible thing to do, they were just shot by their own people. Right, the NKVD. So this is the decrepit, disgusting way that the Russians have always fought. Right, and so you know what? I tend to believe that maybe the high numbers are probably correct. That's what they've lost 28,000 men is the high estimate from the Ukrainian official Ukrainian, you know, or Kiev Independent, or and some other sources. Yeah, now thinking about it, right after all this time since all this, war started, I'm starting to think that probably that high estimate's correct because of the way the Russians and the Soviets have always fought.
But realistically, it seems as though they might have taken control now of those areas that were in dispute. Now that there's no dispute, because they knocked out.
Okay. That's one thing. Now I forgot to mention that you brought up earlier with Mariupol. It has fallen, right? The Ukrainian government did confirm that the remaining troops making the last stand in Azovstal did surrender, but they were taken into Russia.
Okay.
So they'll be tortured and probably. They'll be tortured and maybe murdered or killed. Who knows? It won't be good for them. But, hey, they're Nazis, so let them, you know, if the Russians torture them, I'm sure those apologists won't, you know, care less about it.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about is if you had any knowledge about that hospital bombing, which, our media did show us. And as soon as I pointed that out and said, why in the hell would you bomb a maternity ward? It's like, oh, well, that was, baby making factories. And, also they have bioweapons labs there. All this stuff, like no matter what it is, right? Well, why did they bomb the apartment buildings? Well, you know, Nazis got to live somewhere. Okay. You know, it's just no matter what I say, no matter who the victim is here. Okay. And in some cases, look, there could very well be a Nazi faction. There does seem to be some evidence of that. Now, I question as to who actually funded it, keeps it going. And I'm not sure if there's not more than one hand, going into that pocket to give it money. Okay. Just saying, you might disagree with me about that, but I'm just saying objectively, all these targets and things that have been blown up, some of the stuff that's been shown to us, and even they made the attempts to say, oh, you know, actually, they're showing us Ukrainian casualties, and it's all fake. I just look at it, and I go, no matter what I say, you're not going to admit that whoever it is you're supporting might be doing the wrong thing in any way, shape, or form. It all has to be turned back around to justify what's going on. So do you know anything about that maternity ward or about the biochemical labs over there that were making biowarfare weapons? And I'm saying to myself, man, Ukraine had a lot more going on than I thought because the one lab that they bombed, they said it was a biochemical lab. What I've been able to find out is that it was a testing lab, and it wasn't – there was no bioweapons in it. They were actually doing, like, medical research, and they destroyed a medical research facility, not – And I don't mean to say that medical research facilities could not sometimes be the cover for bioweapons labs, because I live in America. I'm not that stupid. I happen to know what some of my government does. But I'm just saying that, you know, no matter what you say, they'll turn it back around. But do you have any knowledge about that stuff, about what's going on there and the different things that have been thrown up as like, look, you know, the reason why that had to be taken out is because it was doing, you know, the evildoers are there, as George Bush used to say, right? The evildoers. Why did you bomb the maternity ward? Well, a maternity ward can also be a good place where, you know, those Nazi troops can get, what did they say? You know, like medical attention. It's just no matter what you say, no matter what you point to, it goes to that. So I was just curious if you had any insights on those stories.
Not any more than what you yourself would know, right? But look, it's absurd. Look, they keep these clowns in the old media keep blaming it. Oh, it's all Azov, you know. Oh, Azov did a false flag attack and bombed their own people. They're killing their own people. That's just absurd. For example, let's take Butcher, right? There was some kind of atrocity committed there when it was occupied by the Russians, right? So, but then you had a clown like Ryan Christensen saying, oh, I've got evidence that Azov did that. How? It was occupied by the Russians. So the Azov guys were in Mariupol, holed up, surrounded. It's a 20-hour trip by train to get from the south of Ukraine to the north. So how the hell did these guys and these same clowns are saying, well, the Russians have air superiority. So how did we fly them there or get them there, right, when they were all in Mariupol fighting? Right, it's just absurd. These guys live in another reality. You just have to logically, you know, just back off and think about it, right? Right. If a Butcher was occupied by the Russians, then the Ukrainian army wasn't there. They did not do that. That's the logical, what a logical human being would conclude. But these alt media outlets are all trying to blame Ukraine and pushing this, you know, Nazi narrative, pushing it hard still. You know, the Azov regiment's finished. Those Nazis are gone. But these idiots are still going to push this BS, right? This is a dangerous narrative, Chuck, that they've been pushing hard every day, every month in, month out, year after year, for 8 years. And that narrative is getting us killed here and our homes lost. We're not all Nazis here, right? For example, remember how I used to say in other good alt media outlets like J.G. Michael over at Parallax Views, you know, 2% support maximum for the far right here. Contrast that with France, where an actual Nazi, Marine Le Pen, got 23% support, right? So, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Why is Ukraine being singled out for all this Nazism when there's other countries in Europe who have way more support for this? Like, have you got one of those, you know, those two clips I sent you? Are they ready to roll, Chuck?
Well, I didn't get them ready to roll because I figured I needed them if you were not going to be on the show, but I'll get them.
No, don't worry. You can put them. Don't worry. Look, on the Grey Zone on Redline, Aaron Maté featured a guy called Nikolai Petro, right? And this guy's a dangerous lunatic. What he was saying was, right, in that clip number one, which I sent you, he said, oh, to counter that 2% support for far right, which means there's no far right in the Ukrainian parliament anymore, right? This is collectively, they only got 2%. What he said was, the influence of the far right is not determined by votes, right? So what he was saying was, okay, so the other 98% of Ukrainians who didn't vote for the far right, they support Nazis and are Nazis anyway. This is the logic of these dangerous lunatics, right?
I have that clip, by the way, if you want to run it here.
Yeah, go with clip number one.
Okay.
Please.
The scope of its influence is not defined by the number of votes it gets.
Okay. So what this guy's logic is, let's draw an analogy, everyone who voted for Republicans and Democrats in the US election, they didn't vote. They support the Ku Klux Klan and David Duke. It's that kind of logic. You know, or they're all racists who support, people who... white supremacists who hate black people. It's just absurd.
I promise you that there is probably a 2-3% support among people that would classify themselves as white in the U.S. of organizations like that. I guarantee it.
It's absurd to say the other 97% are also supporters of Nazis because the votes don't matter.
Of course it is absurd to say that, but I'm just saying that if you told me that, look, 3% of white Americans support that, I'd say, okay. I probably wouldn't even argue that. I would say that the 3% of people that and probably 1-2% of other races support those ideals, to be honest with you. You know, so one way or another, you're always going to have – but to, like you said, to – actually judge an entire population based on a 2-3% support. I mean, think about the horrible things. There's probably never mind. I'm not going to go there, but guaranteed there is significant support for a whole bunch of atrocious, really horrible things among a population in this country or any other that if you wanted to justify, well, we got to eradicate that 2-3% of the population. Well, if that's where you're going, okay, but, you know, you're telling me kill all the dogs because a couple of them bit people. You know, you can't do this. I mean, this is not the way to – anyway, what about this second
– Exactly. Here? I roll the second one now.
Finally have a united Ukraine. And the influence of this thinking extends far beyond a handful of far-right radicals. This thinking has been espoused openly by several Ukrainian presidents, by Viktor Yushchenko, the hero of the 2004 Maidan as president, publicly, and by several prominent Ukrainian writers and political thinkers. But that's all.
Okay.
Okay, so, right.
So, well,
right, now you go first, Chuck.
Yeah, really quickly, I just want to say that you could say that the David Duke type mentality, which was the softer, kinder, gentler clan, you could easily say that if we understand, and by the way, it's not that far in our past that the clan was seen as a proper, nice civic organization in the United States, believe it or not. Yeah, it's less than 100 years ago. All right. I'm just saying acceptable, reasonable. You could be a politician. It might help you to be a member of the clan. Okay, anyway, that happened here. To say that, okay, you got your 2-3% support for that, and to say that there's probably an influence and individuals that adhere to some of that ideology who don't necessarily join up with it directly, and then you could say, well, that influences another group of people. That may be true, but again, you're talking about not the majority of the population. You're talking about maybe not even a significant minority among the population. Because as I said, if you got 2-3% of white people, and you got to go with white people as a label to start with, supporting it, what do you have then? Maybe 10% that passively support it? Okay, so now let's go with 12% and maybe another 10% that, you know, even more passively kind of, well, I go along with it, but I really don't want to get that deep and dark about it. Even if you got a quarter of the people that are white in this country, I mean, would that justify an invasion and let's just commit a genocide against white people from an outside invader? I'm just curious. Would it? I mean, that's an open question.
No, it does not.
But go ahead and make your statement here because I don't want to run you out of time. And I'm sorry I didn't have those clips ready right away, but I got them. So go ahead.
No, that's fine. Just right. So what he was saying, he said it extends far beyond, right? Far beyond, right? And he went on to say it's infected all of civil society, right? So what he's saying is these a few thousand guys their thinking now is what all 40 million Ukrainians also think. So, in other words, by extension, Ukraine needs to be denazified. And what that is code talk for is de-Ukrainianized. This guy's a dangerous lunatic with his concepts, right, far beyond. And it's all civil society that's infected. So we're all Nazis here, and we all support Nazis. And you only have to extend that to the degenerate thinking of Vladimir Putin to see how that has led to what's going on here now. And these guys are trying to justify it. So instead of showing sympathy for what's going on here, and they're defending the rapist and not the one that's being raped. It's just disgusting and vile. To advocate such things, right? And also, right, I think those two guys were Jewish, right? And they're going to bat for Russia. You know what Sergei Lavrov said, right? He said that Hitler was partly Jewish to try and steal the high ground from Zelensky. That's disgusting and despicable. I would think anyone who was Jewish would think, you know what, maybe I was wrong defending Russia and... because of what Lavrov said, you know, most of the oligarchs were Jewish, like Khodorkovsky, that he destroyed and threw. There's obviously some despicable side to Russian society that they never mention, and they're going to bat for these. Like for example, Marte has in the past said, Lavrov and Putin, they're the adults in the room, you know, because... You know, guys, you know, Western politicians are all clowns. They're not the adults in the room. Would an adult in the room say that Hitler was partly Jewish to try and... That's just a clown. That's a disgusting...
Well, see, that is the weird thing here, Amir, is that the people that I would have thought, and this might expose my own ignorance here, but the people that I would have thought would have guilt by association and always going with, you know, the sins of the father have to follow on to the son, I would have thought that since the Russian Federation is the logical successor to the Soviet Union, that these kind of guys would be just through guilt by association, through historical memory, turn around and say, well, I can't side with the thing that came out of the Soviet Union. Well, I can't side with, but it's weird. It's like they detach all of that. Okay. They detach the history. They detach, you know, they have no trust in anybody who's ever been, you know, anywhere near intelligence operations, but a guy who was a key figure with Soviet intelligence, he's trustworthy. He means what he says. He couldn't possibly be deceptive. He's telling the truth. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around this. Now, somebody said in the chat room that there are people that are conflating in the U.S. being pro-Trump with being pro-Putin, which I understand that it is conflation, but it's also not totally illogical because these guys have made statements about each other. They have signaled their virtue as to being supportive of one another. So, yeah, they go, oh, I'm pro-Trump. I got to be pro-Putin. Some people are doing that, I think. I don't think it explains it all, but I understand that point. Anyways, Amir, I want to give you the final 5 minutes to say whatever it is you want here, whatever it is you want people to know. And, again, I'm just so grateful that you are okay. You are surviving through this situation. And you're in a safe place at the moment. I also pray that it remains safe, brother. So please do, and also give my best to Allah. But anything you want to say here for the next couple of minutes, floor is open to you. I will not interrupt.
Oh, no, it's okay, Chuck. If you want to chime in, please do. Look, there's, you know, all right, there's misinformation on both sides. You know, but a lot of this stuff, you know, like is just trivial nonsense, like, you know, the ghost of Kiev and all that, you know, and silly Twitter, you know, nonsense like that. That's just all neither here nor there, really, right? This whole thing, you know, with people who you know, Russian speaking, you know, being sort of pro, you know, pro-Russian. Well, that's been proven very wrong, hasn't it? Because Kharkiv, Russian speaking, and they don't want Russia, Odessa, right? Russian speaking, and they don't want Russia either. So, you know, like the, you know, commentaries being said that, oh, Ukraine's a divided country, so it has no right to exist. You know, that narrative of Ukraine not being a country is being pushed, but that's like saying, America's a divided country, so maybe America doesn't have the right to exist. You know, all countries have divisions, but it doesn't mean that that justifies that a country does not have a right to exist. And we've gone over the history, right? The Ukraine's been trying to be a country for 300 years, and the Russians won't let them. Well, and these caveman brain, sphere of influence kind of thinkers just keep pushing it, and it's wrong. Like, I just ask people, all right, the mainstream media does, you know, the grandstanding, you know, we now call it virtue signaling, right? And whether or not they really care about anyone here, it's a bit beside the point, because I think their core narrative is probably far more accurate than the narrative you're getting from the alternative media Kremlin outlets, right?
Yes, that's the scary thing there, right, is that even though it is disingenuous, it might actually contain a little more factual information. Not saying that it contains a lot, because, again, I still see these guys, you know, reporting from different places. And for a little while, they sent some of their best people in, but they had to send Don Lemon to Poland because can't risk him in there. But anyway, that's a joke. The thing is that this is the kind of situation where I think the atrocities themselves are not going to be fully realized until long after. And I think that that we're going to come to find out that this is just yet again another aggressor who has decided that they are well within their rights to determine the future of a country which is not theirs. It's just that simple. Even if some people speak the same language, even if they sort of look the same, it doesn't mean that they can claim the rights of the future of an entire group of people who have declared themselves Ukrainian. So, you know, it's that simple. The ancestral right is one thing, the circumstance is another, and they all lead me to believe that that this is just something that should not be happening. It's just that simple. I'm sorry, Amir, but go ahead.
All right, so just quickly, one thing that flew under the radar that probably no one knows about, in 2010, some substantial oil and gas fields were discovered here in Ukraine. In around the Kramatorsk region, there's a huge gas field there, which I think was planned in 2013, just before the Russians invaded. They were planned by 2020 to have that gas field delivering something like 45 million cubic feet per month, right? So, and there's oil off the Black Sea coast, right? So, and Exxon was going to start doing, you know, deep water drilling there, right, around 2013. And guess what? That has all been put on hold because Russia invaded. So there's a multifactorial thing going on here. Like maybe they want – because Ukraine could replace Russia as the main supplier of gas to Europe if the gas fields around where I used to live in the East were developed, right? So
at the end of it all, in all honesty, this could just be another play for resources with the military. Mm. And that could be really the simplest answer as to why this is actually going on. The other things, all the stuff that we basically discussed here, a lot of justifications from, again, just an empire looking to expand or suppress competition, one or the other. And, gee, I wonder, does the U.S. do that too? Yeah, it does. But anyway, pay no attention to that because it doesn't fit the narrative. Anyway, Amir, I really appreciate you taking this time. I want to talk to you again soon. Maybe we don't have to do it on the air even, but I want to get a full update as to what it is going on, because I am concerned about you, man, you know, personally, but I also hate seeing any of this going on. And again, I think war in and of itself is a crime. I don't care what side you choose. And I'm not saying that to you, Amir. I'm saying that to the listener. But anyway, thank you for doing this with me, brother.
You're welcome. And war is a crime, Chuck. I agree with you.
Absolutely, man. How could you not if you are a rational and moral individual of any kind? Anyway, in the next hour, we'll be talking to Dave O'Brien on the Ocelli Effect, but I hope that we have learned something here in this first hour. Stick around.
Wrong. That's what's so funny. I switched glasses when your back was turned. Ha ha, you fool. You fell victim to one of the classic blunders. The most famous is never get involved in a land war in Asia, but only slightly less well known is this. Never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah,
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain, okay? Because people want to support you, they love you to death, but honestly,
so if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this, Billy, because, you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War
by author Mike Swanson.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Nibiru, also known as Planet X, was going to get within the gravitational pull of the Earth and cause mass commotion and chaos?
More that. More commotion. More confusion. It goes into the confusion thing. Head going, nothing's going back, and it's going crazy.
I hate being confused like that.
But that's exactly how he works it.
It is. But at the Ocelli.com radio network, you're never confused.
No, no. It's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
It's about time. Forget this new bureau stuff and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
.com, and he'd get it right where you want to hear it at. Right straight ahead instead of ding-donging back and forth here.
Ocelli.com.
When, boy? When are you going to get your act together?
Gross.
Oh, good God almighty me. I think he's the Antichrist.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
Learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all powerful.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. But, of course, you wouldn't realize that we're slightly late starting the second hour here on the live stream if you're listening to the podcast, which most of you do. So appreciate you no matter who you are, where you are, or when you are listening to this. Welcome to it. So in the first hour, we talked to our friend in Ukraine, got an update there. In the second hour, we're going in a completely different direction from that, but something that every listener of mine is definitely familiar with, which is the JFK assassination. Now, here is an author which I've never actually interviewed myself before, but he has been on the network elsewhere. So this ought to be a little different as per usual. And I'm really actually happy to have the guy who is, if you go to the website, ThroughTheOswaldWindow.com, if you go there, you'll learn about a couple of things that this gentleman has written, along with, you know what, I'm going to screw up his name, Johnny Carnes. And, you know, the way that he pronounced it with his accent, I was a little unclear as if I had it right. But anyway, Johnny also contributed to some of this gentleman's writings, including, guess what, a book that's titled just like the website, Through the Oswald Window. Maybe I'll get Dave O'Brien to explain that to me, because that's who I have with me. How you doing, Dave?
I'm great, Chuck. It's great to be with you and your listeners. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, and I appreciate your work, and it is a bit odd, your work. Now, why do I say that? Well, first of all, love the color scheme on the one book where it's very loud, very yellow. You know, I have a bunch of books on my shelf, and some of them kind of blend together because they all look the same. People have adapted black and white photos onto them. And there's usually some sort of muted color scheme and all that. Yeah, somebody with a very different thought process designed that cover for your book. But also the title is interesting because Through the Oswald Window, it almost bothers me to hear that title. Now, this almost sounds like I'm going to be hostile to you, Dave, but just bear with me a second. Okay. the thing is, I'm not so sure that that's the Oswald Window. But I know what you're talking about, and that would be the window on the sixth floor of the school book depository that allegedly is the outlet for the sniper's nest, right, in the official narrative. And, of course, you can't get to it today because it's behind a bunch of plexiglass and there's a lot of boxes and stuff like that. But at one time you could. And you could actually look down and see where he allegedly aimed the Mannlicher Carcano, or Carcano as it is more properly pronounced, and, you know, that World War II surplus rifle with the old ammunition in it that was kind of shaky and everything that allegedly scored one of the greatest assassinations in the 20th century by killing President Kennedy. And by greatest, I do mean most significant, not like it was a good thing. Anyway. Why did you name the book Through the Oswald Window? And maybe if you get a chance, tell me a little bit about the color scheme, which is pretty loud, and I like it. go ahead and tell us about the title and the book itself, please.
Thanks very much, Chuck. The second book is called JFK Case Not Closed. And the only reason I really selected, with the help of my brother Paul, a bright color scheme is because I wanted it, in fact, to contrast against the first book that I wrote, Through the Oswald Window, because it it does has images and that are some are black and white and all that. So it's you can't play with that as much. And I wrote Through the Oswald Window, and I called it Through the Oswald Window because the Warren Commission, in naming Oswald as the lone assassin of JFK, as you know, named Oswald as the assassin at that window. And so, therefore, technically, it's the Oswald Window. And I built a case in the book, Through the Oswald Window, that Oswald was never at that window, did not fire a shot from that window. But nonetheless, it's still the Oswald Window. And when I went there in 1979, when the building was closed and sealed to the public, I made some observations from the window that made it clear to me that Oswald, or whoever it was at that window, could not have been a lone assassin that day in Dallas.
Well, yeah, today it is part of the Sixth Floor Museum exhibit, which you can visit by appointment, and you can pay some money there. And they got a gift shop and everything, right? No, at one time it was closed to the public, and it was sort of in disrepair, that building. I'm thinking now, I didn't see it in 79, but, you know, I've seen it over the years in photographs and was able to visit there a couple of times. I got to say, it's very interesting, the transformation from, to, you know, to what it is today, from what it was there for a very long time. You know, again, a very significant spot. I mean, it's a huge thing for tourism in Dallas and all that. I'm glad you wrote the book. And by the way, Case Not Open, I actually want to do a separate show on that. But I was referring to it to get the conversation started, because when you go to your website, it jumps out at you. When you go to ThroughTheOswaldWindow.com, that book, that cover jumps right out at you. And very much is reminiscent of Howard Weisberg's Case Open, which, again, are like two echoing responses to Gerald Posner's work, Case Closed. But we'll get there. Let's stick with the Through the Oswald Window a bit, because, what is the significance of that, though? Because you had looked at it, you had examined it, you had come to the conclusion that there's no reason that somebody should reasonably assume that this was done through this window by this character, all that. But it's kind of has a deeper kind of sounding meaning to me. Like, if you look through this window, you should realize this, I guess. But today, most people can't. Although they used to have a camera. Do they still have that camera that allegedly shows you the perspective of the sniper? Because you used to be able to go to that online somewhere and, like, look down at Dealey Plaza and the traffic going by. Is that still a thing?
I think there's a camera as part of the exhibits at in the museum itself. And it, of course, it shows the assassination from the perspective of that window only. But I can guarantee you, Chuck, that if you stand at that window and you look down into the kill site through the eyes of the actual assassin, and we know there was an assassin at the sixth floor southeast corner window of that building, then I can guarantee you that the perspective you gain is completely different than what the Warren Commission wanted us to believe, and we did believe for up to 12 years before Geraldo Rivera showed the Zapruder film in 1975. Prior to that, nobody had any cause to think that the shots did not come from any place other than I called it the Oswald Window, by Oswald. Well, now we know that that is simply not the case. Oswald could not have been at the window at 12:30 p.m., and there was an assassin, but it was not Oswald, and there could also not have been shots fired only from that window. There had to be at least two other locations involved in assassinating President Kennedy.
Okay, so let's start with that. Okay, I know why I think there were shots fired from other places, but what would be the key pieces of evidence that you present in the book to explain that you have certainly multiple shooters? What would be the observable pieces of evidence, again, I keep having to use that word, that would suggest to the reader that your thesis is correct? Where do you start with that?
Well, I can start this way. As I stood at the window, first of all, you have to crouch or kneel down in order to shoot out the window. You can't stand and shoot. It's a very awkward position in which to carry out a very precise assassination against the president of the United States. Now, trained marksmen will tell you it's not that difficult a shot, but when you take into account that he was shooting at the president of the United States and he had some obstacles and he had some time restraints, it's not as easy as it looks. And those kinds of things, Chuck, are what come into perspective when you actually stand at that window and look down into the kill site. So, for instance, the first thing I observed as I looked down the window was, and I based everything on a lone assassin perspective. So okay. I'm there as a lone assassin. And so as I looked down the window, it occurred to me, the first thing that occurred to me was the limousine was approaching me at that window on Houston Street. And so I wondered, why didn't the assassin, if he was a lone assassin, why didn't he fire at the president's car as it approached him on Houston Street when it was such an easy shot? It was incredible. But he didn't. He allowed the limousine to make a sharp left-hand turn and begin to move away from him before he began the shots. And that's when I really discovered the big problem of there being only one gunman. And that's the old tree.
Yeah, one second. Here, before we go to the tree, I looked at this and I looked at the FBI film and put into a presentation that I did some time ago, something that I'm curious as to whether you considered. I looked at the Houston Street and I say to myself, well, maybe this window isn't that good. But, you know, there is only a few feet away another window on the corner of that building that, quite honestly, if I was thinking about taking a shot at somebody who's coming up in a car, who's moving slow, I might have chosen the other window just to the left. If you were facing out and staring at that window, to your left, only a few feet, is yet another window. Did you consider that as far as the, you know, from Elm onto Houston and then on to, from Houston onto Elm, other way around. From Houston on Elm, why not take the shot on Houston from the other window if you have access to it? You're right there in the corner. Did you look at that?
I sure did. And in fact, it's fascinating because of this. I was positioned, as the assassin was, apparently, at the sixth floor southeast corner window. And as you just described, Chuck, if you look to your right at the far at the other end of the building, the southwest corner, building, right at that corner, there's an identical window. And I believe that is a much smarter assassin's perch than what the sixth floor southeast corner window was. Now, I was able to make an observation of like that of a smarter assassination location in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes at that floor. Mm-hmm. Where we know that Oswald worked there for 3 or 4 months before the assassination, or whoever the assassin was, they were in a position to scout that floor as an assassin lair for a considerable amount of time, whereas I picked out this southwest corner window in a matter of 3 or 4 minutes. Now, when you go over to that window, it's remarkable because now the oak tree doesn't have anything to do with the assassination. It's completely out of play. You've got a clear shot at the president right directly beneath you, and you've got somewhat of a time constraint, but it's no less of a time constraint if you were at the other window before the limousine disappears under the triple overpass. So you're correct, and here's a really interesting thing about that because I wrote about it in my book, and I also do an article on my website about that southwest corner window. Well, I went there in 2018 for the 55th anniversary. I visited the museum, and you know what I found? It was really fascinating. That one window only on the southwest corner of the Texas Book Depository building is now sealed off. It's blackened by a screen, and it's got metal fastenings, so you can't look down through that window into the kill site. But you can look at every other window along Elm Street, except for the two corner windows. I find that absolutely fascinating. And when I questioned them about it, they had no answer for me as to why you couldn't see from either window.
Well, you see, all right. The reason why I present the one to the left as opposed to the one on the other side of the building is that I'm going with the idea that we've got a lone assassin. So I'm thinking to myself, if you take a shot at him coming down Houston, he's still going to turn onto Elm. You might be able to take another shot at him going down Elm, but I definitely wouldn't pick that as the primary place to shoot because you have obstructions. The window you describe would have removed the obstructions and still given you about the same amount of time where you have exposure to the vehicle. So I get that. But if I was just a guy, even if I wasn't there for weeks or months or whatever, if I was there for 2 hours, I would have looked at it and said, okay, where is the car going to be if I wanted to do this? All right, now where can I take a shot? I might have selected that corner that the alleged sniper's nest is in, but I would have two different windows. If I, you know, miss, which is always a possibility, if I miss, I can take another shot going down Elm. You know, and they there was a point at which, by the way, they used to have a video game online, which I'm sure you saw JFK Reloaded at one point that somebody put out. And another commentator made a point that, well, when I played the game, I just shot the driver. You know, in an assassination, that might have not been a bad plan either. There's a lot of things to consider here. It's very weird that he picks this very narrow sort of way in an awkward position, okay, because the window is lower to the floor than most people might think a window is.
Yes.
There. So it's a very odd choice for somebody who's bound and determined to do this. I mean, you know, you don't say, well, I'll take a shot at him, and if I miss, it's okay, I'll go to lunch. I mean, you gotta have some determination, some finality to this plan. Which is equally strange considering the next parts of it that you're going to bring up here, including his escape, by the way, which not well planned there either if it's one guy planning it, because he gets on a bus, gets in a taxi. I mean, you know, this is not reliable transportation to get you out of an area if you're trying to escape as an assassin. I mean, something's wrong there, Dave. Anyways, please continue about the window, though, because you were saying that not only is there a better choice, but the obstruction was the next thing you were going to about the oak tree.
Right. So if you're positioned as the assassin in the southeast corner window of the Book Depository building, what happens quite quickly after the limousine makes the left-hand turn on Elm Street is that it goes under a large, mature oak tree. And unless the assassin was so good that he could fire between leaves and branches and stuff and find his target, he had to wait until the limousine cleared the foliage of the oak tree before he could begin the shooting, even get off the first shot. In doing so, he had a phenomenal reduction in time in which to carry out the assassination. So I found that the oak tree was a major, major obstacle for a man positioned at the southeast corner window. But if you go over to the southwest corner window, he's positioned already past the oak tree. And once the limousine comes out from behind the tree, it's one of the easiest shots you can possibly imagine. And now you mentioned the word escape, and that actually begins in the building. And one of the other things that I noticed, Chuck, was that as far as the escape goes, if he was at the southeast corner window, as the commission says, in order to get to the northwest stairwell that goes down in four flights to the lunchroom, he had to, at that time, go through conveyor lines and belts of books and boxes of books, and it was not a straight line. He had to zigzag all over the place to get to that window, but or to the stairwell. But if he was at the southwest corner window at that building, it was a straight beeline from that window to the stairwell and down the stairs, and that would have been, again, a much wiser choice by a lone assassin who wanted to, A, make sure he got the best possible shots off, and, two, make sure he got away. And so when you're in the building itself, you can just see that the whole thing makes no sense. There's a much smarter sniper's nest, as you pointed out, in the same floor, just windows away.
Right. Well, there were other choices, too. I mean, if you really examine it, if you were trying to pull this off, there's just a whole lot of better choices to have been made here. I don't think anybody states that Oswald was a complete idiot. and couldn't have planned something out. But there appears to be no intelligence in this plan. And yet, you know, that's the thing that somebody like Posner would say all the time, and they still drag him out every now and then to address it and say, you know, the reason why people can't believe this is because it's so ridiculous that such a loser would have been able to take out the president. And I'm like, okay, well, let's go with your theory. You know, if he is indeed the loser, I mean, well, it's almost more believable that he would have a better plan. I don't get how he doesn't have a better plan. I've always pointed out, too, that if he does indeed have the revolver back at the rooming house, right, why wouldn't you bring that with you? Because if you're going to shoot, stash the gun, and run, you might encounter resistance trying to leave the area. I might want to have a weapon on me, which would not be all that uncommon in Dallas, for somebody to be carrying a gun. It might not even be remotely suspicious, unless you had to draw it on somebody because they were suspicious of you. But you got to be able to think ahead a little bit. And again, there should be a better escape plan. I mean, good point, though, about that other window that would have been a straight line to the stairwell as opposed to having to weed through all those lines. And if you don't believe that, by the way, you can look at the Allier film, which will show you that there was stuff everywhere that he had to get around. You can see those guys climbing over stuff to search through the rows and everything.
Right.
There's a lot of things there for him to have to contend with and run around. And, you know, I try and run around my own coffee table. I bang into it. I mean, I know it's not an excuse, but, I mean, I'm just saying it's very, very odd, the whole thing, the whole scenario. So,
you know what else is fascinating, Chuck? Talking about the escape, if he had gone, again, to the other window, southwest corner, he may have avoided the confrontation with police officer Marion Baker. As it turns out, the commission tells us that Oswald had an encounter with a police officer 90 seconds after the shooting in the second floor lunchroom, and then where Officer Baker actually pointed a gun at his head, and then when the building superintendent, Roy Trulli, said, oh, no, he works here, the officer just said, oh, okay, and they went on their merry way. So what was interesting when I was at that sixth floor window is I said, well, I'll do a test. I was 27 at the time in fairly good shape, and I went from the sixth floor down to the second floor lunchroom in just under 90 seconds. So that's doable. But here's the difference. When I got down to the second floor lunchroom after hurrying, I would not have passed the visual test that Oswald apparently did when he encountered Officer Baker. I was my palms were a bit sweaty. I was a bit flushed in the face. I wasn't breathing overly hard, but again, I was not comfortable. I looked like I had just run or done something, and yet the officer, Marion Baker, says Oswald looked totally calm and collected. Well, that just tells me that Oswald was in the second floor lunchroom while the shots were being fired, just as he said he was, and just as a witness by the name of Geraldine Reed said he was, and he could not have been at that window because he would not have looked that way had he met Baker having just run down four flights of stairs.
Yeah, the reason why I'm dissecting this part so deeply is because I usually don't. So this is a little unusual probably for my listeners. So I want to ask you another question about this escape scenario, and then I'm going to turn it over to you to tell them whatever it is you want about the book and stop asking you questions.
That's right.
But the one thing that is also interesting to me is, did he or did he not have the soda? And I'll tell you that I even spoke to Marion Baker for about 30 minutes at one point, investigating this. And when I was much younger and did not have my questions well prepared. But what's interesting to me is I believe his story. Some people have tried to say he was mistaken or he had things wrong. I think he actually tells that story that he encountered this guy. He is calm and collected. But a lot of people always focus on this soda, and I think it's more significant than some people give it credit for because, and yeah, I know there's a dispute whether it's a Coke or a Dr. Pepper or whatever. That's not important. But what is important is that not only did he have to make it down there through that stuff, which you didn't have to weed through because in 79, there probably wasn't all that stuff on the sixth floor, right?
Correct.
Okay. So there's that. Plus, you didn't have to get a soda out of a 1963-era machine, which is probably older than a 1963-era machine, which doesn't function like a soft drink dispenser today. Today, you know what? You put some coins in or a dollar or whatever, and your soda gets dropped after you press a button. That wasn't the type of machine that was in the second floor. You had to get a bottle out, which I'm pretty sure everybody said he had a bottle. And getting that bottle out involved putting the coins in and actually opening a little door and pulling a bottle out. I know it sounds like it's nothing, but that adds to your 90 seconds. If he's got that soda in his hand, he had to get there, get the soda in his hand, and be spotted by Baker, and Baker comes through the door. So if that's 90 seconds right there, part of that time is spent getting that soda. So what do you think of that?
Well, I don't know if this helps your position or doesn't, but there's a witness that's very important. Her name is Geraldine Reed, and right. she was interviewed by Robert Groden, and she claims that she was on the second floor opposite the lunchroom, and that Lee Harvey Oswald came up to her and asked her for change for the pop machine, which she provided. Now, as they were going through this process, Geraldine Reed said that the shots were fired, and that as Oswald was standing before her, and that they just looked startled at each other. They weren't sure what it was, and she gave Oswald the change. And she says she saw him go back into the lunchroom and purchase a bottle of pop. She didn't identify what it was, but she thinks that he did have a pop. And then very soon thereafter, Oswald is encountered by Officer Baker. But the thing that I've always focused on about that exchange is that it absolutely proves that Oswald was not on the sixth floor southeast corner window as the shots were ringing out. But now what that does to the timeline with him and Marion Baker is interesting. And I don't know that we have a complete story about that that we can tell. But that's the Geraldine Reed is a very important witness. And the pop, I think the pop is very important. And I think that what did Baker say about that, Chuck, when he was with you? Did he see a pop?
He seemed to indicate that there was a bottle of soda in his hand. I was really struck by the weird thing he said to me when I wasn't recording anything, which was, you know, if I would have known that he was going to be that much trouble, I would have shot him myself. Because he was irritated with, you know, all the questioning, all of the people that had approached him and everything over the years. He was totally aggravated with me, too. And I wasn't even asking really deep questions. Just tell me what happened, because this is a key factor for him to get down those stairs, you know. He seemed to support the idea that Oswald was probably the guy. But at the time, you know, he wanted to make a point of it that they weren't necessarily looking for somebody who worked in that building, because they figured it had to be somebody else. You know, yeah. These guys were busy doing things or whatever, or on lunch break. And it wouldn't have been an employee. That was the point he wanted to make to me. And so I just, you know, I didn't ask a lot of questions when these guys get rolling, because I would just let him speak. And I spoke to several DPD officers, and some of them contradict each other, by the way, when they tell stories. You know, so I'm just saying, take everything with a grain of salt. But he seemed to believe that, you know, okay, I don't know what the circumstance was, but that's how I found him. And I stick by the story that he wasn't flustered. He seemed fine. But I don't know how he got there or what the timeline was, but that's what I saw, is what Marion Baker was telling me.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, because it was only when Roy truly identified Oswald as an employee that he dismissed Oswald as a suspect and went on their merry way.
Right. No, and I'm just saying that I believe that Marion Baker wasn't making up stories. Some people have claimed that he was. I really do think he was just doing the job that he thought he was doing. So, you know, anyways, All of that aside, though, that's only the beginning of the story and only the beginning of what you talk about in this book. And also, like I said, a separate time, I'd like to talk to you about Case Not Closed, because that in and of itself is a different discussion, I think, but kind of the same discussion. So I'll just turn it over to you. Tell us the rest of what it is we can find in this book. And also, I will make sure to include the link to the website. I'm going to put it in the chat room in just a moment here for you guys listening live. But if you're catching the podcast, it'll be down there with the show notes. A link directly to purchase the book. Go to Dave O'Brien's website, because, again, that's who I'm speaking to, author Dave O'Brien, who has written these two very interesting books. Today we're talking about Through the Oswald Window, which coincidentally is the website's name, throughtheoswaldwindow.com. So you put all those things together, one word, and then .com, Through the Oswald Window. So, Dave, tell us the rest about what we can discover. Obviously, not everything, but give us an idea about what else we can discover in Through the Oswald Window, please.
Sure. It's basically a smorgasbord of various things that I discovered. In fact, what's interesting about it is when I read the entire Warren Report, including the 26 volumes, I was 13 and 14 when I read them. And what I found, even at that age, was I was startled at how much contradicting evidence that was published in the Warren Report. All you had to do was find it, or how much was omitted that you heard elsewhere. Evidence that was, and that's why I used it as part of my title for JFK Case Not Closed. I was stunned by how much evidence I encountered that I learned was either dismissed, ignored, altered, or suppressed by the Warren Commission in order to name Lee Oswald as the lone assassin of President Kennedy. And of course, one of the problems, Chuck, is that he was not allowed a lawyer while in police custody, and then he was killed, and he was not allowed a lawyer to represent his interests before the Warren Commission. And so they, in essence, became a public trial of Oswald. And yet, the thing that I remember a quote by Mark Lane, and he said, the best way to disbelieve the Warren Report is to read it. So I had read his book, Rush to Judgment, when I was literally 12 years old. And then my next, because he said that, I said, I'm going to read the Warren Report. And my gosh, he was right. And so I decided I was going to eventually write a book where I went through all this kind of evidence that I found that either was wrong or made up, or like, for, I'll just give you an example. Of all the witnesses they examined and talked to, it's astounding to me that of the 600 plus witnesses in Daley Plaza, they talked to less than 1% of them. And even less than 1% of those witnesses were witnesses who claimed that they may have heard or seen, or, you know, a puff of smoke or a flash of light or a sound coming from a direction other than the book depository building. So it was astounding to me that the witnesses that they had were there for the convenience of the conclusion that they would arrive at, that Oswald acted alone. Whereas when I looked at the witnesses and talked to some people and read some other materials, any witness, even the witnesses who pointed to the shots coming from the book depository building, even those witnesses tell us that there was more than one assassin. Mm-hmm. How do they do that? Well, because when asked what the spacing of the bullets were, everyone said, and I'll just use the words bang, everyone, Chuck, said the spacing of the bullets were like this: bang, bang, bang. Now, we know that the second and third shots fired so rapidly toward each other could not have come from the Oswald Mannlicher-Carcano rifle, because the minimum firing time manually was 2.3 seconds. And so that's the kind of stuff that I kept encountering. And then it was other stuff like the ballistic tests. Why didn't they ever track the metallic fragments taken from Connolly's body and try to match it to CE-399? And to then Oswald's rifle. So they presented this single bullet theory, for example, and did nothing to provide evidence to, in support of it.
Yeah.
And in fact, a lot of the ballistic results that they provided prove that it could not have been one bullet that caused all the non-fatal wounds in the two men. And so I was observing this as a young researcher, and I said, I don't understand this. And so I was hooked. After I encountered stuff like that, I was hooked, and I just kept at it and kept at it. I developed a pen pal relationship with Dr. Malcolm Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Now he didn't divulge anything to me that we're not already aware of, but I do know, having talked to him before he died, and again this was in my youth, that he was really pissed that about the Warren Commission and also journalists in general, the media. He was upset because he felt that what his comments were at the press conference and in his testimony before the Warren Commission was grossly taken out of context. That's his opinion. So, for instance, the Warren Commission infers that he inferred that the exit or the front throat wound on the president was an exit wound. And he tells me in one of the letters, which I donated to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, that he could not state that the throat wound was either entrance or exit. And so he was angry that the Warren Commission used him as a supplemental piece of evidence to say this is why Oswald acted alone and this is how he did it. And so, and the same thing with the media. He was just upset with them. But so in developing all these relationships and talking to all these people, a case against the Oswald acting alone, it just grew and grew and grew until eventually I just had to put it in a book called Through the Oswald Window.
Fair enough. You know, a quick question about Malcolm Perry, who is somebody who I did not get a chance to speak to personally, is this. It took us until the early 2000s to really circulate the original bit of the press conference where he made statements about that entry wound. And some people might have had it earlier, but I was a tape trader, and believe me, we were trying to accrue this stuff for years in the 80s and 90s. Trying to get all the original footage of everything, you know, again, internet not being what it is today. And it's fascinating to me because his original statements right there on the scene would have contradicted what they were saying he said in all these other places. Even when they brought him on CBS to be interviewed, the way they cut up what he said, it misrepresented what he said that day in the moment while he was still at it fresh in his mind because he had just seen it only maybe, an hour before? And I would not blame him for being angry. Another guy who was pretty disillusioned and not happy was Chuck Crenshaw,
right,
who was present too. Did you ever contact him? But also, forget that question for a moment. I want to know if he knew about that press conference footage and how difficult it was to dislodge that from media archives. It took like 20 years for somebody to get a hold of it when they were making the efforts. Did he know about that? And I guess on the other thing is, did you ever talk to Charles Crenshaw, who was also authored a book, Trauma Room 1, and assisted other researchers over the years because he certainly had contradictory observations to the official explanation as well. So, those two questions. Did he know about the press conference footage, Dr. Perry? And secondly, do you know about Chuck Crenshaw and his and did you ever contact him?
Yeah. To my knowledge, Dr. Perry had no information about the press conference footage. And in fact, he made an effort to be reclusive and just get rid of this whole thing. I was shocked when he replied to my handwritten letter in 1968, and that's an example of why it's so tragic that Oswald never lived to stand trial, because had he done so, Perry would have been called as a witness, of course, and we may have clarity today about the wound that he observed and saw versus the confusion that we have about it. I never did interview Crenshaw, but I did speak with J. Gary Shaw, who wrote a book with him, two books with him, actually. And so I was familiar with what Dr. Crenshaw saw, as well as it led me to speak with Dr. Robert McClelland. And also we now know, as I'm sure you've talked about in previous shows, there are now up to 46 medical professionals in total who have all told somebody, whether it's the Warren Commission, House Select Committee, ARRB hearings in the 90s, that they saw a massive exit wound on the right rear of the president's head, which, of course, indicates that the kill shot could not have been fired from the rear. There's now 46 such medical professionals who have claimed that, and Crenshaw was one of the leading ones. And to his credit, he went through quite a bit in maintaining that position when he wrote the book with J. Gary Shaw.
Yes, he did. And one other thing here. Look, I don't mean to offend you as an author, but I'll tell you something. If you want to get a good handle on it, I would say look at William Mattson Law's work on this, where various witnesses to what happened to JFK's body are all collected in one place. His work is invaluable. Completely priceless as far as trying to collect that stuff together if you didn't have the opportunity to talk to these individuals yourself. I'm talking to the listener, not you.
Totally agree, Chuck. And also, I would highly recommend the work of Douglas Horn, who served on the Assassinations Records Review Board.
Oh, yeah.
He does a phenomenal job of tracking the possibility of Kennedy's wounds being altered between Parkland and the autopsy room.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot to be said about that. I don't want to go there with you necessarily, but I appreciate Doug Horn's work, though. I'll tell you that I miss my 5-volume set. I need to get another. Because his Inside the ARRB is also one of those essential things. If you want to have an educated bookshelf on the medical evidence, you need William Mattson Law's work, and you need Doug Horn's work for sure. Even if you don't agree with all of Doug's conclusions necessarily, you can't ignore some of the primary evidence that he and he alone actually presented. And now other people are actually recognizing and did at the time when he released it. But anyways, no, but both of those authors, though, I would definitely suggest people read along with your book, though, because, again, you go through a lot of different things here. You don't just focus on medical evidence. You do touch on it. But there is a great deal more in there. So outside of ballistics, medical evidence, the historical record, which, you know, again, I find it interesting that the Warren Commission successfully did one interesting thing that undermines their case nicely, which is lay out the activities of Lee Harvey Oswald leading up to the assassination. And if their reckoning of that is to be believed, there's not a lot of time for planning, folks. Just telling you, as a matter of fact, I agree with some of my colleagues who have come up with a 72-hour window without certain insider knowledge that would have been impossible to obtain. So, you know, maybe he just was working on short notice, Dave. That's a joke. Sorry. but the point is that there's a great deal to explore here. Again, not just ballistics and the window and Dealey Plaza, but you go into a lot of other stuff. And the Warren Commission, another thing they did pretty well is they seemed to want to talk to a lot of the employees at the school book depository. Harold Norman comes up to my mind because he is one of the people who didn't quite go along with that, you know, disconnected shot scenario sound you made. He had the idea that it was pretty equal, but he was in a minority. I mean, among people that claim to have heard those sounds.
Right.
And here's the fun part about it is as much as they try and tell you there's a concise story that's easy to follow in their own volumes, as you said, they've literally got tons and tons of contradictions right there. I almost feel like somebody thought nobody would bother to read it all, you know, because if they did, and Mark Lane, again, I loved some of the stuff he used to do publicly where he would talk about, you know, there's a whole exhibit in here on Jack Ruby's mother's teeth.
Yeah.
So a lot of garbage in there that wasn't necessary. a lot of contradictory evidence that undermines their own claims one way or another. And by the way, Warren Commission defenders, when they were first presented that, used to say, well, you see, it can't be a cover-up. They allowed contradictory evidence in there. So I'm curious what you have to say about that line of thinking where they say, see, they had troubles there because and whatever, but they showed you some of the contradictory evidence. I'm smiling because I'm sure you got a great answer for this. So what would you say to somebody who says that, Dave?
Well, if they had a lot of contradictory evidence that they published, they did a phenomenal job of hiding it. This was all on purpose, Chuck. For instance, we had the 888-page summary edition, which is what millions of people read, and which I read. But what was very clever is that they had 26 volumes of supplemental information. And that was, they only printed about 5,000 copies of those. And so it was distributed to libraries and a few other places. So unless you dove into the supplemental volumes, as I was able to do, you would have no trouble buying the story that they told you in the summary edition, which was all the information you wanted to know. So to give you an example, just one little example, in the summary edition, you won't find the testimony of Officer Bobby Hargis, who was riding on the left rear bumper of the president's car, just over the Jackie's left shoulder. Right. You will find it buried in one of the supplemental 26 volumes. And the key to that is that as he was riding along the limousine, at the back of the limousine, he was struck so strongly by a spray of the president's blood and brain tissue that went on his police helmet and visor that he nearly lost balance on his motorcycle. And the shot, because the flow of that blood and brain matter went back toward him, that told him as an expert gunman that the shot came from the right front of the car. And he dismantled his bike. He ran up the grassy embankment to the grassy knoll because that's where he thought the shot came from, saw nothing. And when he tried to tell that to the Warren Commission, they took his testimony and they never mentioned him in the 888-page edition that they printed millions of, only the 5,000 editions of the supplemental volumes that hardly anyone ever read. Mm-hmm. And there's thousands of those kinds of situations that I could point out and I do that in through the Oswald window.
Well, for instance, there's three family members who testified to the Warren Commission that were witnesses, and they were opposite the side of the road that would have been the grassy knoll. Like, in other words, they're across the street from the grassy knoll, right?
Yeah.
They claimed they saw a bullet hit the turf there on that little island, and it's there in the Warren Commission, but is it mentioned in the 888-page single report? No.
Yeah.
You know, which would have been something that might have been dispositive of a shot coming from the school book depository.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. It's the key stuff is there in the 26 volumes, but it's so disorganized, so buried, so boring. And meanwhile, if you read the executive sessions and you start to get into asking these people about their testimony, you find their testimony was cut off anyway. They would have said more. They were being told, taken off the record, hey, you know what, tell us about this. I mean, what was it, Willis, who took pictures, right?
Right.
He had a completely different take on this. I mean, Nick's had a completely different take on this. You know, some of the famous photographers, right, who had captured amateur images of the assassination had a completely different take on what it was they were observing that day. They were there.
Right. And
testimonies were either suppressed, manipulated, changed. Depends on who you talk to.
Well, the last thing I would say about through the Oswald window is that the timing was not an accident. I waited a long time. And then on 2018, as we were approaching the 55th anniversary, there's something I noticed about the Zapruder film that I hadn't noticed before. And like a lot of researchers, I've viewed the Zapruder film hundreds and hundreds of times. And I found something very fascinating. It's not so much what the Zapruder film shows us. It's what we don't see in the Zapruder film that we should see if there was one assassin from that window firing all the shots. And so in the book, I point out and I provide a link to a animated video that I helped create, which shows the problem. And the problem is this, and we use Newton's second law of motion, which states that for when an object strikes an object, when a projectile strikes an object, it moves in the forward of the direction where the object, where the projectile came from. So to give your audience an example, if you take the back of your head and you just gently with your open hand tap the back of your head, what does your head do? It goes in the forward motion because that's what your hand did. And so when you look at the Zapruder film, something occurred to me. At frame 312, we see Jackie attending to her husband, Jack. She's right in front of him, right? Her face against his face. It's amazing to see. Her left hand is at his chin. She knows that something's wrong. And yet the fatal headshot has not occurred yet, Chuck. And so 1/18th of a second later, the fatal headshot occurs. And yet what happens? As a result of that shot, Jackie jumps onto the rear of the car and picks up a piece of her husband's head. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not what should have happened if the shot came from the rear. What should have happened? Jack's head should have struck Jackie's head because it was about 2 inches away and directly in front of him. If you just do that test with your hand in the back of your own head, it doesn't take much to move your head an inch or two forward. Here we have a high projectile, energy-packed bullet that strikes the rear of the president's head, and it doesn't move his head 2 inches forward to bang into the cheek of his wife, Jackie. It makes no sense at all, and it defies Newton's second law of motion. So I do a video, an animated video, and I put it in through the Oswald window because I believe that what the Zapruder film doesn't show us also confirms that one person from the book depository window could not have fired all the shots that day.
Well, you know what convinced me is the first time that I got a really serious high-quality copy of the Zapruder film and looked at it very carefully frame by frame is you can literally see her move in, and I swear to you, I can almost see her mouth something which, you know, would be typical, like, confusion. Like, are you all right? What's going on? Something, a bit of concern. You can see the expression on her face. There's no sound, obviously, but you can see that. And then with that headshot at 3:13, I mean, you literally see stuff splash in her face. You see her react with a reflex because she's been hit in the face with, well, what is probably blood and brains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you consider, again, the angle she's at, and like you said, leaning forward to try and get in front of her. I mean, real world example, you know, if somebody's reaching up and he does have his arms up all of a sudden, if you were sitting side by side with somebody who was doing that and you weren't driving, you might lean over and say, you know, hey, what's going on? You okay? You can literally watch that happen. And to me, it's incongruous with the idea that that shot came from the rear alone. Because if it did, I almost think that a bullet going through should have hit her, depending on the angle. Now, I've had people argue with me about this, but I got to be honest with you. When you look at it from that perspective, I mean, it could be I'm wrong about this, but to watch it happen, I just, and to look at it in that great a detail, I don't see how anybody can support the official explanation, and that's given that that is a legitimate film, okay, mm-hmm. Which I know people argue about. I don't want to do that because we're out of time, actually. But I do want you guys to go over to ThroughTheOswaldWindow.com and check out the work of Dave O'Brien, who also has a bit of a contribution from Johnny Carnes, who is an interesting character in and of himself, and I like his methodology, I'll tell you that. just out of the gate. This is a guy who I want people to hear from in the future a lot more. But also no offense to you again, Dave. I mentioned other people during this interview.
That's fine.
But you got to admit that it's the work of some other people that often will inspire somebody else's work. And I think that you wouldn't. I mean, you mentioned Mark Lane and a few others. It is something that can be built upon. And I'd like to see, you know, people build on your work, actually, and get at some of the multiple angles again, because the whole truth is certainly not just through the Oswald window. But that's where Dave's book is. I'll give you the Amazon link. You can buy it there. Or you can go through the website. And I want to have another discussion with you about Case Not Closed, which, again, I have to stop myself and make sure I don't say case open, because I have that Weisberg title right here behind me. Of course, I'm pointing at something, and I'm on the radio because I'm an idiot. But anyway, I want to thank you for taking this time. Dave O'Brien, once again, thank you, sir.
My pleasure, Chuck. I look forward to speaking with you and your audience again.
Absolutely, and we will do that, but not today. The Ocelli Effect is done. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Thanks to Amir. Thanks to Dave O'Brien. Through the Oswald Window.com. Go there, get the book. It's a good one.